Chapter 107. Functions, as you may have heard me mention, are not in a good state, and rest might improve them. But I shall not rest, sir, while I am your representative. Whenever you want me, you will find me here. Summon me anywhere, and I will come. During the long vacation, sir, I shall devote my leisure to studying your interests more and more closely, and to making arrangements for moving heaven and earth, including, of course, the Chancellor, after Michaelmas term. And when I ultimately congratulate you, sir, says Mr. Voles with the severity of a determined man, when I ultimately congratulate you, sir, with all my heart, on your accession to fortune which, but that I never give hopes, I might say something further about you will owe me nothing beyond whatever little balance may be then outstanding of the costs, as between solicitor and client not included in the tax costs allowed out of the estate. I pretend to no claim upon you, Mr. C., but for the zealous and active discharge, not the languid and routine discharge, sir. That much credit I stipulate for of my professional duty. My duty prosperously ended, all between us is ended. Voles finally adds, by way of rider to this declaration of his principles, that as Mr. Carstone is about to rejoin his regiment, perhaps Mr. C. will favor him with an order on his agent for £20 on account. For there have been many little consultations and attendances of late, sir, observes Voles, turning over the leaves of his diary, and these things mount up, and I don't profess to be a man of capital. When we first entered on our present relations, I stated to you openly it is a principle of mine that there never can be too much openness between solicitor and client, that I was not a man of capital, and that, if capital was your object, you had better leave your papers in Kenge's office. No, Mr. C., you will find none of the advantages or disadvantages of capital here, sir. This, Voles gives the desk one hollow blow again, is your rock. It pretends to be nothing more. The client, with his dejection insensibly relieved and his vague hopes rekindled, takes pen and ink, and writes the draft, not without perplexed consideration and calculation of the date it may bear, implying scant effects in the agent's hands. All the while, Voles, buttoned up in body and mind, looks at him attentively. All the while, Voles' official cat watches the mouse's hole. Lastly, the client, shaking hands, beseeches Mr. Voles, for heaven's sake and earth's sake, to do his utmost to pull him through the court of chancery. Mr. Voles, who never gives hopes, lays his palm upon the client's shoulder and answers with a smile, "Always here, sir. Personally, or by letter, you will always find me here, sir, with my shoulder to the wheel." Thus they part, and Voles, left alone, employs himself in carrying sundry little matters out of his diary into his draft bill book for the ultimate behoof of his three daughters. So might an industrious fox or bear make up his account of chickens or stray travelers with an eye to his cubs, not to disparage by that word the three raw-visaged, lank, and buttoned-up maidens who dwell with the parent Voles in an earthy cottage situated in a damp garden at Kennington. Richard, emerging from the heavy shade of Simmons Inn into the sunshine of Chancery Lane, for there happens to be sunshine there today, walks thoughtfully on, and turns into Lincoln's Inn, and passes under the shadow of the Lincoln's Inn trees. On many such loungers, have the speckled shadows of those trees often fallen, on the light bent head, the bitten nail, the lowering eye, the lingering step, the purposeless and dreamy air, the good consuming and consumed, the life turned sour. This lounger is not shabby yet, but that may come. Chancery, which knows no wisdom but in precedent, is very rich in such precedents, and why should one be different from 10,000? Yet the time is so short since his depreciation began that as he saunters away, reluctant to leave the spot for some long months together, though he hates it, Richard himself may feel his own case, as if it were a startling one. While his heart is heavy with corroding care, suspense, distrust, and doubt, it may have room for some sorrowful wonder when he recalls how different his first visit there, how different he, how different all the colors of his mind. But injustice breeds injustice. The fighting with shadows, and being defeated by them necessitates the setting up of substances to combat. From the impalpable suit which no man alive can understand, the time for, that being long gone by, it has become a gloomy relief, to turn to the palpable figure of the friend who would have saved him from his ruin, and make him his enemy. Richard has told Voles the truth. Is he in a hardened, or a softened mood, he still lays his injuries equally at that door. He was thwarted, in that quarter, of a set purpose, and that purpose could only originate in the one subject that is resolving his existence into itself. Besides, it is a justification to him in his own eyes to have an embodied antagonist and oppressor. Is Richard a monster in all this, or would Chancery be found rich in such precedents too, if they could be got for citation from the recording angel? Two pairs of eyes not unused to such people look after him, as, biting his nails and brooding, he crosses the square, and is swallowed up by the shadow of the southern gateway. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Weevil are the possessors of those eyes, and they have been leaning in conversation against the low stone parapet under the trees. He passes close by them, seeing nothing but the ground. William, says Mr. Weevil, adjusting his whiskers, there's combustion going on there. It's not a case of spontaneous, but it's smoldering combustion it is. Ah, says Mr. Guppy. He wouldn't keep out of Jarndyce, and I suppose he's over head and ears in debt. I never knew much of him. He was as high as the monument when he was on trial at our place. A good riddance to me, whether as clerk or client. Well, Tony, that as I was mentioning is what they're up to. Mr. Guppy, refolding his arms, resettles himself against the parapet, as resuming a conversation of interest. They are still up to it, sir, says Mr. Guppy, still taking stock, still examining papers, still going over the heaps and heaps of rubbish. At this rate they'll be at it these 7 years. And Small is helping? Small left us at a week's notice. Told Kench his grandfather's business was too much for the old gentleman and he could better himself by undertaking it. There had been a coolness between myself and Small on account of his being so close. But he said you and I began it, and as he had me therefore we did I put our acquaintance on the old footing. That's how I come to know what they're up to. You haven't looked in at all? Tony, says Mr. Guppy, a little disconcerted, to be unreserved with you, I don't greatly relish the house, except in your company, and therefore I have not, and therefore I proposed this little appointment for our fetching away your things. There goes the hour by the clock. Tony, Mr. Guppy becomes mysteriously and tenderly eloquent. It is necessary that I should impress upon your mind once more that circumstances over which I have no control have made a melancholy alteration in my most cherished plans, and in that unrequited image which I formerly mentioned to you as a friend. That image is shattered, and that idol is laid low. My only wish now in connection with the objects which I had an idea of carrying out in the court with your aid as a friend is to let them alone, and bury them in oblivion. Do you think it possible, do you think it at all likely I put it to you, Tony, as a friend, from your knowledge of that capricious and deep old character who fell a prey to the spontaneous element, do you, Tony, think it at all likely that on second thoughts he put those letters away anywhere, after you saw him alive, and that they were not destroyed that night? Mr. Weevil reflects for some time. Shakes his head. Decidedly thinks not. Tony, says Mr. Guppy as they walk towards the court, once again understand me, as a friend. Without entering into further explanations, I may repeat that the idol is down. I have no purpose to serve now, but burial in oblivion. To that I have pledged myself. I owe it to myself, and I owe it to the shattered image, as also to the circumstances over which I have no control. If he was to express to me by a gesture, by a wink, that you saw lying anywhere in your late lodgings any papers, that so much as looked like the papers in question, I would pitch them into the fire, sir, on my own responsibility. Mr. Weevil nods. Mr. Guppy, much elevated in his own opinion by having delivered these observations, with an air in part forensic, and in part romantic, this gentleman having a passion for conducting anything in the form of an examination, or delivering anything in the form of a summing up, or a speech accompanies his friend with dignity to the court. Never since it has been a court has it had such a fortunatus's purse of gossip as in the proceedings at the Rag and Bottle Shop. Regularly, every morning at 8, is the elder Mr. Smallweed brought down to the corner and carried in, accompanied by Mrs. Smallweed, Judy, and Bart. And regularly, all day, do they all remain there until 9 at night, solaced by gypsy dinners, not abundant in quantity, from the cook's shop, rummaging and searching, digging, delving, and diving among the treasures of the late lamented. What those treasures are they keep so secret, that the court is maddened. In its delirium it imagines guineas pouring out of teapots, crown pieces overflowing punch bowls, old chairs and mattresses stuffed with Bank of England notes. It possesses itself of the sixpenny history with highly colored folding frontispiece, of Mr. Daniel Dancer and his sister, and also of Mr. Elves, of Suffolk, and transfers all the facts from those authentic narratives to Mr. Crook. Twice when the dustman is called in, to carry off a cartload of old paper, ashes, and broken bottles, the whole court assembles and pries into the baskets as they come forth. Many times the two gentlemen who write with the ravenous little pens on the tissue paper are seen prowling in the neighborhood shy of each other, their late partnership being dissolved. The soul skillfully carries a vein of the prevailing interest through the harmonic nights. Little swills, in what are professionally known as patter allusions to the subject, is received with loud applause, and the same vocalist gags in the regular business like a man inspired. Even Miss M. Mulvillison, in the revived Caledonian melody of We're a Nodding, points the sentiment that the dogs love brew, whatever the nature of that refreshment may be, with such archness and such a turn of the head towards next door, that she is immediately understood to mean Mr. Smallweed loves to find money, and is nightly honored with a double encore. For all this, the court discovers nothing. And as Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins now communicate to the late lodger whose appearance is the signal for a general rally, it is in one continual ferment to discover everything, and more. Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy, with every eye in the court's head upon them, knock at the closed door of the late lamented's house, in a high state of popularity. But being contrary to the court's expectation admitted, they immediately become unpopular, and are considered to mean no good. The shutters are more or less closed all over the house, and the ground floor is sufficiently dark to require candles. Introduced into the back shop by Mr. Smallweed the younger, they, fresh from the sunlight, can at first see nothing save darkness and shadows. But they gradually discern the elder Mr. Smallweed seated in his chair upon the brink of a well, or grave of waste paper, the virtuous Judy groping there like a female sexton, and Mrs. Smallweed on the level ground in the vicinity snowed up in a heap of paper fragments, print, and manuscript which would appear to be the accumulated compliments that have been sent flying at her in the course of the day. The whole party, Small included, are blackened with dust and dirt, and present a fiendish appearance not relieved by the general aspect of the room. There is more litter and lumber in it than of old, and it is dirtier if possible. Likewise, it is ghostly with traces of its dead inhabitant, and even with his chalked writing on the wall. On the entrance of visitors, Mr. Smallweed and Judy simultaneously fold their arms and stop in their researches. Aha! Croaks the old gentleman. How de do, gentlemen, how de do? Come to fetch your property, Mr. Weevil? That's well, that's well. Ha! Ha! We should have been forced to sell you up, sir, to pay your warehouse room, if you had left it here much longer. You feel quite at home here again, I dare say. Glad to see you, glad to see you. Mr. Weevil, thanking him, casts an eye about. Mr. Guppy's eye follows Mr. Weevil's eye. Mr. Weevil's eye comes back without any new intelligence in it. Mr. Guppy's eye comes back and meets Mr. Smallweed's eye. That engaging old gentleman is still murmuring, like some wound-up instrument running down, how da do, sir, how da how, and then having run down, he lapses into grinning silence, as Mr. Guppy starts at seeing Mr. Tulkinghorn standing in the darkness opposite with his hands behind him. Gentleman so kind, as to act as my solicitor, says Grandfather Smallweed. I am not the sort of client for a gentleman of such note, but he is so good. Mr. Guppy, slightly nudging his friend to take another look, makes a shuffling bow to Mr. Tulkinghorn, who returns it with an easy nod. Mr. Tulkinghorn is looking on, as if he had nothing else to do and were rather amused by the novelty. A good deal of property here, sir, I should say, Mr. Guppy observes to Mr. Smallweed. Principally rags and rubbish, my dear friend. Rags and rubbish. Me and Bart and my granddaughter Judy are endeavoring to make out an inventory of what's worth anything to sell. But we haven't come to much as yet. We haven't come to, Mr. Smallweed has run down again, while Mr. Weevil's eye, attended by Mr. Guppy's eye, has again gone round the room and come back. Well, sir, says Mr. Weevil. We won't intrude any longer, if you'll allow us to go upstairs. Anywhere, my dear sir, anywhere. You're at home. Make yourself so, pray. As they go upstairs, Mr. Guppy lifts his eyebrows inquiringly, and looks at Tony. Tony shakes his head. They find the old room very dull and dismal, with the ashes of the fire that was burning on that memorable night yet in the discolored grate. They have a great disinclination to touch any object, and carefully blow the dust from it first. Nor are they desirous to prolong their visit, packing the few movables with all possible speed, and never speaking above a whisper. Look here, says Tony, recoiling. Here's that horrible cat coming in. Mr. Guppy retreats behind a chair. Small told me of her. She went leaping and bounding and tearing about that night like a dragon, and got out on the housetop, and roamed about up there for a fortnight, and then came tumbling down the chimney very thin. Did you ever see such a brute? Looks as if she knew all about it, don't she? Almost looks as if she was crook. Shoo-hoo! Get out, you goblin! Lady Jane, in the doorway, with her tiger snarl from ear to ear and her club of a tail, shows no intention of obeying, but Mr. Tulkinghorn stumbling over her, she spits at his rusty legs, and swearing wrathfully, takes her arched back upstairs. Possibly to roam the housetops again, and return by the chimney. Mr. Guppy, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, could I have a word with you? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.